On Friday, October 18th, the Norris Group proudly presented its 6th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joined Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude's Children's Hospital. This event could not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Property Radar and Sean O'Toole, Housing Wire, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association and President Bill Tan, Investors Workshops and Sean Watkins, Angel Bronsgeist and Sarah Benora, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Barry, MVT Productions, Rhoda Construction, Wilson Investment Properties, and White House Catering. For event video and information, visit isurvivedrealestate.com.
We're going to introduce our next two speakers. I'll begin with Deborah Still. Deborah Still, CMB, is President and Chief Executive Officer of Pulte Mortgage, a nationwide lender that's headquartered in Inglewood, Colorado. Deborah recently served as Chair of MBA's Residential Board of Governors and is member of the Association Board of Directors. And next we have Mark Palin as Vice President of Applied Economic and Housing Research at Fannie Mae. Mark is responsible for overseeing the economic and strategic research groups, forecasting functions, and manages multidisciplinary partnerships across the company to address specific business issues facing Fannie Mae. His work focuses on the impact of trends in financial service sector on the economy and on Fannie Mae. Mark, thank you for your patience. I'm going to get to the report that you wrote. It was a short report, but the impact of rising interest rates on housing recovery and the history of that. I guess I wanted to ask you about the refi programs. Have they benefited as far as the characteristic of people making payments on time? Have those improved in, say, 2012 and 2013 versus their former efforts? And have price increases really helped people, you know, stick with the payment structure and make that a safer program?
You know, in general, we've seen a decline in delinquency rate, and we've seen it for quarter after quarter. So our book is performing a lot better than it was a few years ago.
Right.
You know, if someone gets a refi, that does help their monthly budget out and should help the loan perform well over time.
And those programs have changed and morphed, and now there's programs where appraisals are not necessary, and they can get a refi over 100% loan-to-value, is that accurate?
I'm not sure 100%
okay.
About that one. But,
that's okay. That's okay. No, I know you're mostly in the economist section. Well, let's talk about something you're very familiar with, and this is a concern of the group in this room because interest rates are going up. You know, we've had the luxury of some ridiculous rates, and we still have ridiculous rates as far as anything I'm used to. Just because they started with a 3 for the last year doesn't mean that that's anything normal, but now that interest rates going up, the thought is, okay, well, that's got to be damaging to price or volume of sales. So share with us a little bit about the research that you did and the time frames that that covered.
Sure. So it stands to reason that people think if mortgage rates are rising, then you would expect house prices to drop. But it turns out, if you look at the historical record, that isn't really the case. Generally speaking, interest rates rise when the economy is doing better. Demand for lending goes up. But when the economy is doing better, employment's doing better, and people have higher incomes so they can afford a larger payment. The exception you see to that is if you see a large increase in interest rates over a short period of time. And then in the two most recent instances we've had of that, what you've tended to see is a slowdown in sales, and prices have continued to appreciate, but not as fast as before. The other thing you've also seen is people will shift to ARMs for a couple of quarters. So you'll see the market share of ARMs going up. Now, this time around, we're not seeing as much of a shift to ARMs. One of the reasons is probably because of also the new underwriting rules that we were just talking about, where you have to underwrite to what the payment will be in the first 5 years, so that is slowing down the shift to ARMs. So far, we've seen a little bit of slowing in new family sales and pending sales, but the market so far has held up okay.
When rates shift, does it sometimes get people off of the fence? People have been waiting for the interest rates to turn into 2%, but then it went up to 4. At some point, maybe you're jarred into action going, well, maybe it's going to get to 5 someday. Oh, my goodness.
Right, and that's a great point you bring up, because one of the things we saw was, you know, the 10-year rate went up to 2.90 and mortgage rates moved up between May and September. And then when the Fed didn't taper, you've seen both 10-year rate and mortgage rates come down 25, 30 basis points. And in the MBA data on applications, we have seen a little bit of a pickup in refi. Setting that aside, refi volumes are down dramatically this year because that's just very rate sensitive.
Sure, and people already have the rate that they of their dreams. What's going to be interesting, and this audience is very capable of this transaction I'm about to describe, we may buy somebody's property that has an existing loan with a very favorable interest rate, and we may want to keep it in place. And I know that's not the rules, but we're going to do it a lot, I can tell you that.
Well, it's funny, because that's where private capital is probably going to play a role in wraps and all sorts of creative stuff from the 80s.
Okay, so blended rates and things like that. Okay, very interesting. And they're ready to play that game with us a little bit?
You know, there are a lot of rules for small creditors, so you're going to have to read the CFPB's 3,500 pages to decide whether you can play in that space.
I won't do that until Monday.
Get a good attorney.
Could I wait until Monday? That would be good. I've had my share of reading. What type of loans that used to be common aren't coming back?
Yeah, so the new rules, and we can already see, I'll talk about MBA's credit index, but we can already see some products that have been very popular in the past, and good products. Some of the products, the exotic products, should have gone away. Think pay option arm. But, you know, you've got IOs, which are now prohibited in the QM definition. You've got balloon payments prohibited in the QM definition. You've got loans with more than, and this is for the high-cost markets, loans with more than a 30-year amortization schedule prohibited in the QM definition. And so some otherwise good product will not be allowed in if you're going to meet the definition of QM in a safe harbor. MBA just started a mortgage credit availability index in February. And just in February, it was the baseline, so we set it at 100 basis, or 100. Credit loosened up a little bit. We've been at about 111, and that's sort of the jumbo market coming back for wealthy borrowers recently. Well, it's starting to drop. It's down to about 107 because some of these products are disappearing. Just to give you a sense of context, if we were at the height of the housing bubble, that number would have been 800. So, again, an indication of how overly tight the credit conditions are today.
The cap on fees, 3% over $100,000 and no dual compensation, can you kind of explain that and how different is that from what the mortgage industry is used to?
Yeah, so the definition of QM, one of the criteria is the borrower cannot pay more than 3 points, and we talked about the definition of what that constitutes. One of the things MBA would take exception to is if you're an affiliated business, affiliated means mortgage and title, you have to add the points that the borrower pays or the cost that the borrower pays to the lender and the title company together. So more loans will basically not meet the QM rule. The other thing that MBA would take exception to is if you are a broker, you must count the fees that are paid to the broker in addition to the lender. So the compensation paid from the lender to the broker is counted in the borrower's 3-point calculation. So it really puts a disparate impact on wholesale lending and the brokers.
What percentage of loans, let's say, in 2013 wouldn't meet QM, do you think?
What I do know is that if you look at the data for basically loans that have gone into foreclosure, what percent would have been subprime versus Alt-A versus prime versus QM, they've looked at all of the data and suggested that QM will be slightly more conservative than what you and I would call a prime loan back in the day.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Do you have any data?
No, and, you know, there is some data out there. Different people have put numbers out, but, you know, one of the problems with that question is that if something isn't QM, what's the consumer going to do next? Are they going to look at a house that's a little cheaper? Are they going to bring a little bit more cash to the transaction? So, you know, you can run numbers on people's, you know, originators can do this. We can look at our portfolio and say, of originations in year X, how many loans were over 43 DTI? And that's an interesting number, but to me what's even more interesting is how's the industry going to respond and how are individuals going to respond when their lender says, listen, I can't get you into this $250,000 home. You got to put more down or look at a different house.
Yeah, if you look at the three-point rule, though, there is definitely a negative impact of small loan amounts. And so in the business I'm in, where we do a lot of loans to active adults in the Dell Web business, you've got large down payments. And so you've got cost being associated on the title side with sales price. You've got fees being calculated into a low loan amount, and actually large down payments hurt the borrower. It's right. Almost an unintended consequence. These two things, the fees to brokers and the title affiliate, mortgage and title affiliate, these are two things that the CFPB will tell us we can't fix. We believe Congress intended the impact to affiliates, intended the impact to brokers. Go back to Congress.
If you create a loan that doesn't meet QM standards, what does that mean? That it's a portfolio loan, you're going to keep it?
In the short term, there are likely going to be portfolio lenders, credit unions, community banks, and maybe some of the large depositories that may choose to do good non-QM loans and put them in their portfolio. For those of us that are independent mortgage bankers that have to sell their loans, since the GSEs now will no longer buy anything but a QM loan, we will make those loans if private capital comes back and someone will buy them and there's a secondary mortgage market.
Okay, but outside of that, you won't.
Which is why we think it's going to take time to see. You all talked in an earlier panel about the uncertainty. I think private capital is going to wait and see what this regulation exactly does before it's back. I think that's the expectation.
How big of a change is 43% back end to what you guys were used to in, I don't know, just pick another year. Is it much more restrictive, the back end?
If 43, if you take out FHA and you just maybe use the GSE and you might have some data, but I think most of our calculations directionally, don't quote this number, would suggest that maybe 30% of all borrowers have back ratios in excess of 43%. So it's a big chunk. Now, that temporary patch is going to solve that for a while the GSEs are in conservatorship. But if the GSEs were to come out of conservatorship, we'd have a concern for all conventional buyers. Right now, just jumbo buyers.
Okay.
So
go ahead.
I was just going to comment on that and say, just maybe so it's clear, just a little bit of, you know, inside baseball, D.C. regulatory stuff. But the way the rule was written is that CFPB said, here are the rules, but obviously everyone's concerned about unintended consequences. So if you sell your loan to Fannie, Freddie, or FHA, or VA, or the other government programs, and it meets their standard, then for some of these things like the back-end DTI, that's fine. It'll count as QM. And then it's really up to our regulator or FHA to decide where do they want to set the boundaries. So that is going to give the market at least time to see what the impact is of those rules and create some sort of safety valve for them. The number of the 30 is a little higher than I would have thought from the things I've seen, but, you know, it's definitely still going to have an impact. And part of what's going on, frankly, is credit was too easy. We had the boom and the bust because credit was too easy, and there was a need for credit to get tightened up, and there was a need for practices that some consumers were subjected to get driven out of the market. So we'll have to see how it plays out.
So the pendulum swung way too easy and sort of swung maybe back to way too hard. But that's going to take some time.
Right, it's going to take some time. I mean, there's a couple of different things going on at the same time, right? You have a recession which kills off people's ability to save, to be able to demonstrate the income to qualify for the loan. You had the loss of equity, which means a lot of people are underwater. It makes intergenerational gifts for down payments harder. So, you know, there's a bunch of different things that have hit the housing market beyond tightening credit. There's no doubt that credit is tighter if you look at the average FICO and you look at down payments seem to be less. There you've seen less tightening. But you look at the FICOs, it's clearly tightened. And that really comes from two places. Part of it is people like Fannie have tightened up their standards, but also the lenders have tightened up the standards that they place on top of the standards that we have. So our box in terms of FICO and LTV may be so large, and the actual deliveries we've gotten are concentrated at the higher end of the FICO. One thing we're watching for is to see, as the refi volume disappears and drops off, is more competition at retail going to lead lenders to use more of our box?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look at what has driven lender behavior over the last couple of years, certainly these rules haven't gone into effect yet. That's a new complexity. It's really been repurchases and the loans that have had to be bought back. And if you've been in this industry a long time, the average cost of a repurchase, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, might have been about $10,000, which was the disposition cost of the property, or you know, the loan, if it was current, would have been, you know, not underwater. Now when you buy back a loan, the last couple of years, you know, you're buying back a loan that's a couple $100,000 underwater. And so lenders have gotten very, very conservative, saying, I'm going to lend inside the credit box. I agree with you, Mark, that refinances loosening up will possibly cause lenders to consider lending to the full credit spectrum of FHA and the GSEs, absent now this new environment here first quarter of next year.
Deborah, you had mentioned if Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, they stay in conservatorship. I kind of get the feeling that decision's a long ways away. Do you think it's closer than 5 years?
No, not. I think the debate has started. Well, the debate has definitely started.
Right.
You've got, you know, a bill in the House, the Hensarling bill, the PATH Act, and then you've got the Corker-Warner in the Senate.
I actually read that. That's really exciting.
Which are two ends of the spectrum. So you've got the debate that's going on. You've got proposals coming out, you know, from the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee here probably in the near term. So the debate is very active. The ultimate resolution, I think folks would talk about 5-7 years being the short end of the time horizon.
And, you know, from my perspective, all I'd say is that it's been really interesting to watch the way GSE reform debate has gone the last couple of years. We started out with, you know, generally more academic plans that sort of were in an ideal state. What would you want the U.S. housing finance system to look like? Or, you know, clearly partisan plans. And now this spring and summer, you've really had the beginning of a discussion around by policymakers, economists, and others and on the Hill of what are some of the practicalities of a transition? I don't think anybody is happy with the idea that 90% of mortgages are being, you know, backstopped by the federal government, either through its government programs or through the GSEs. But if you wanted to get to 50, forget getting to zero, if you just want to get to 50, how can you do that? And what would practically involve? What does it mean to bring in private capital? How much private capital do you really need? How can you make sure it stays rather than just comes in when times are good and disappears? So, and that's one thing where I really think it's been a positive development in terms of the level of detail and the substance of the discussion.
Well, and I think, you know, I think at the beginning it was like private capital could fund the marketplace, and there's statistics that would suggest since 1955 private capital has never played much more than about 35% of you know, the funding for real estate. And so I think folks have started to acknowledge there is an appropriate role for government in housing. To your point, what's the percentage and you know, what's the model of the future?
Right. What's kind of interesting is we're about to implement a very restrictive new rule in the midst of the most profitable quarters in history for the lending industry or for Fannie, Freddie, and FHA. And so is there any thought that maybe we've already done more than enough? And is there any chance of, like, cooler heads prevailing saying, well, we don't have to do all this stuff? Or is it too late?
I don't know. There's a lot of wheels in motion. You know, we talked about the 3,500 pages. That's about seven rules. Then you've got QRM right behind it. You've got respitela reform coming out in fourth quarter that'll probably be implemented, you know, within the next year. You've got loan officer steering, which is another rule the CFPB is obligated to issue next year. There's HUD's disparate impact rule is still trying to be figured out right now. You've got another Basel for the banks. You've just got it's all these wheels are already in motion.
Have you ever met anybody that's actually read all this stuff?
Yeah, half the MBA policy team, I think.
Okay. That's a tough assignment. We've run out of time. I'm going to ask one more question about servicing. Have there been significant changes to servicing loans, and particularly the policies if you don't make your payment, what is the responsibility now of the servicer and the lender?
The servicing rule is also part of the 6-7 rules that are coming out in January. That's the 1,200-page rule. Most of the servicing rule is patterned after the large servicing settlement for the large, you know, the five largest servicers in the country that was done, about a year ago. It's very detailed in terms of contact time frames, processes, cycle times, notifications to the consumer, and will basically guide a servicer to follow certain steps all the way from the first payment to, you know, if in fact loss mitigation and ultimately foreclosure would be necessary.
Is the lender forced to do loss mitigation as far as? Well, they go through the process, but they're not forced to say yes. Is that correct?
They have to go through an appropriate process.
Right, but they can decide, no, I'll just take back the asset?
Yes, there's an analysis that now has to be performed, both for the best interest of the consumer and, obviously, the financial obligations of the servicer.
Okay. But ultimately, the person that put the money out, can they decide, I don't want to do loan modification, I just want to go get the asset since you didn't pay me. Is that allowed? Not sure? I mean, because that would be the unintended consequence of that would be, wait a minute, I thought that was okay, and all of a sudden now it's not. That would be a big deal to me.
I would summarize it by saying the appropriate process has to be examined, and it's a very detailed process, and very much the consumer must be informed and involved through the entire process.
Okay, but the lender probably still has some choices. All right, I found that really a very interesting discussion. Thank you very much.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Adrenaline Athletics, Claudia Buys Houses, Coldwell Banker Town and Country, Elite Auctions, Phoebe for Investors by Investors, Homevestors, In a Day Development, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts, Inc., John Merrill Investments, Inc., Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, Lavis Associates, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Investment Club Phoebe, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Pilot Limo, Primary Residential Mortgage, Realty 411 Magazine, Real Wealth Network, REIExpo.com, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Association of Realtors, Sonoka Corporation, Spinnaker Loans, UDirect IRA, Tony Alvarez, The Bottom Feeders, Tri Emerald Financial Group, and Westin South Coast Plaza. See isurvivedrealestate.com for video of the live event and more on our sponsors.